I call the Senate Resources meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 30th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Members present, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and I'm Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Chloe, who are helping us out with the minutes and the audio. We have one item on the agenda today, and that's Senate Bill 280. Title is Oil and Gas Property Tax and Municipal Tax. So we are going to be hearing a presentation today from Glenn Farn and also from the Department of Revenue. So, first up, we have the Department of Revenue up. Say what? Oh, Glenn Farm was going to go first? Okay. All right. Thanks, Paige. Wrong PowerPoint or something. All right. So, Glenn Farm is going to be presenting. We have a variety of people here representing them. There's Adam Prestige, and I think he is... not here.
I'm here on video camera.
He's on the team.
Oh, there. Video yes. Camera. Okay. The other tiny screen. Okay. We have former Senator Mark Begich here from North Compass Group, lobbying organization. Matt Kissinger, commercial developer or director of AGDC. Dan Stickle is not with this presentation. And Ryan Fitzpatrick, commercial manager. He's with Dog. Never mind. So I guess it's just you two from Glen Farn. Let me see if there's any other people from Glen Farn here. Nope. Okay. Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. If you're changing back and forth between speakers, please identify yourself each time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So we have three speakers. I am here on behalf of, I work with Brownstein High, which subcontracts with Northern Compass Group, which advises agency in the governor's office on this project. Along with that, I'll let each person introduce themselves, but Matt from AGDC, and on the online is Adam from Glen Farn. So we'll walk through each one of us. I will have a brief conversation, and then we'll turn it over to Matt and Adam, who will go through each piece. And then at the end, as you mentioned, Department of Revenue will have a full presentation on the revenue spectrum of the project. Let me first say thank you very much for this opportunity to be here and be able to talk about the project. This is, in my view, a once-in-a-lifetime project. I have been working on this first directly with AGDC for the last 5 years, bringing it and helping bring it to this point where it's now in front of us in what we would consider a live project. There's no better unique moment for Alaska to take advantage of this. Could we have predicted two wars that would impact the gas supply of this world? No. Could we have predicted that we would see energy shortages at the level they're at in the Cook Inlet region, not at the level they're at today? This project has been talked about for many years. A lot of people are skeptical of it and still are to this day. But this is the one time, and I have said this before, you know, I play a little poker, tournament poker. This is one I would bet on. I think we're at a 70 to 80% chance of making this project happen. You may disagree or agree with the current president. It's irrelevant. He supports the project. He's made Alaska, through executive order, a number one priority. So that has turned loose the federal tools at this for this project to move it forward in many different ways. You'll hear today from, again, as I mentioned, from AGDC, kind of the status of the project, along with Glen Farn and where we're at. There'll be some information, Madam Chair, that we'll tell you if we can put into the public arena, because there are some proprietary financial information that could impact the cost of the project, but also the pricing that we're trying to get for what we're selling, the gas, Glen Farn selling, and or the price we're trying to get it from the North Slope producers. So it's very important to keep that in perspective. We also have one other thing I'll mention. It's a very unique situation. You have AGDC, the administration, bringing forward the project. You have the legislative body that has to do their due diligence. But we also have a lot of eyes on the project. And what I mean by that, Madam Chair, is you have investors who look at this project trying to figure out Is Alaska unified enough to move the project forward? Is this where they're going to put their investment that could be tied up for many decades in order to get the return they need? And as we go through this, I just ask you to keep that in perspective, because sometimes the questioning, you may think we're not answering. We are. We also would be open to as many meetings you would like, as we've done with the House. I think we've done 4 or 5 meetings already, some private, some in the public arena. We would encourage you, if there's some in-depth questions that we cannot answer on the financial, there may be opportunities to do it through other means, through executive committees or your executive sessions, through LB&A or other choices, just to put that on the record for you. Let me end there, and I'll just turn it. Ready?
Yep.
Go ahead, Matt.
So this is Matt Kissinger for the record, commercial director for AGDC, based out of Anchorage, Alaska. Spoken to you, obviously, a number of times. I just want to set a little bit of the historic context to talk about, bring us kind of up to date as to why property tax is such a big issue right now that we're dealing with. So last year when I was here, I talked a little bit about the phases of the project that we've been through, starting with the producer-led efforts. And I've talked in detail about why that wouldn't work, the producer's cost of capital being a poor choice of cost of capital for such a large capital-intensive infrastructure project, and how they don't traditionally own big midstream infrastructure unless they're working on political risks. So places like Papua New Guinea, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey, these places, they own them. But if you look across North America, they don't own a lot of these types of large infrastructure facilities. We changed in 2016 when the producers handed this project over to the state, and we started this state-led effort where we were out with government-to-government efforts, talking to China, talking to Japan, Korea, et cetera. And in each one of those, we were delivered the message of you need to find a qualified developer, first of all. And also, it wasn't following the proper rigor that a major project would traditionally follow. In 2019, there was a major change within AGDC. Several members of the board were changed out. The leadership was changed out. And this is when we started what I call the alignment first phase of the project, or the developer-led model. And what I mean by alignment first is, and this is really important, to move a big project like this forward, you have to take all the risks and you have to allocate those risks to the parties that are best able to mitigate those. So I'll take one example, cost overrun risk. This project has avoided the reality of cost overrun risk for a long time. It's been treated like a hot potato, passed back and forth. Under this model, under the alignment first model or the developer-led model, it's the developer who takes on that cost overrun risk. And that's important because it's the developer who is entering into EPC contracts and the developer who has the direct management control over all the subcontractors that are building this thing. So that is the best place to allocate that risk, and that's where it sits now. And that model leads us to a lot of the other assumptions that we're making, like on the gas price and why we're not using a net back price. Under a net back model, it's the producers that would actually have that cost overrun risk. Under this model, that's not the case. And so we need to agree on an arm's length transaction for the value of gas at the wellhead. We also, when we made this change to this developer-led model, we also started utilizing a normal stage gate process, which is standard for all major projects. And we decided to pause and kind of go back to an appraise level stage gate, which we call the economic analysis stage gate. And let's look at the fundamentals of the project and see if it truly hangs together. We presented this, as a lead up to this, BP and Exxon helped us in 2019. They funded us and they provided subject matter experts. And these subject matter experts had been involved in these projects for developing LNG plants in the US through the 2010s, where they suddenly became highly modularized. A lot of focus on the source country strategies, et cetera. And they were able to bring down costs, you know, on a per ton basis quite a bit by doing this. So we went back and we did a value engineering exercise with BP and Exxon, and we hired Fluor, big, well-known EPC contractor. And with that, we were able to shave down the costs from the original 2015 estimate down to around $39 billion at the time. There were $44 billion in 2015 dollars. We brought that down to $39 billion in 2019 dollars, and we moved through our economic assessment stage gate. In that stage gate, we determined that this project is economic. It can compete with projects from the Gulf of Mexico. And they're the sort of marginal supplier of LNG. So that's who you really need to beat. We can beat them, but we were sort of middle of the pack. You know, there were more places that we thought we could optimize this. And we identified three main places that we should focus on. First one is on the gas price. So going into 2015-16, they were using a little bit higher of a gas price assumption. It should be noted that this is unprocessed gas that we're buying. This is wellhead quality gas. It has carbon dioxide in it, has H2S in it, has other impurities that we have to remove at great expense. So when we're thinking about that North Slope gas price, you cannot just consider it as a market gas. It's not the same. The next thing that we looked at was loan guarantees. So in 2004, there was the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act at the federal level. And in that act, $18 billion worth of loan guarantees were provided to a project to monetize North Slope gas, send it down to North America through pipeline. This could not be used on this project. Now, these $18 billion, these are CPI adjusted, so they're worth about $30 billion now. And in 2021, our congressional delegation were able to get an amendment to that original ANGPA language, so that these loan guarantees could be used on our project. And they put that into the bipartisan infrastructure law. So we had addressed two of our big issues, the gas price and the loan guarantees, but the third one was property taxes. It was always known that property taxes were going to be too high for this project. But we didn't really know where we stood. So we hired Gas Strategies. AGDC hired Gas Strategies. They're out of London. Well-known intelligence service. We asked them to benchmark property taxes in Alaska with property taxes in Texas, Louisiana, Cove Point, Maryland, Canada, Mozambique, and other jurisdictions. And if we can move to slide 4, I believe it is. Or am I controlling that?
You're controlling it. You're in charge.
All right. Slide 5, sorry. Slide 5. So under slide 5, you see that in pretty much every other jurisdiction, there is some kind of a property tax abatement, some sort of a program, either a PILT or just naturally lower property taxes or lower assessments. But every one of them has that. If I may, moving on to slide 6, you can see how this kind of comes out in the numbers. And I'll talk a little bit about some of these other jurisdictions, or at least the ones that are really relevant. So take LNG Canada. LNG Canada has something called the Revitalization Tax Exemption Agreement, which puts the LNG terminal at lower property taxes over a 10-year period, starting at $1.62 million the first year and ending at $9.7 million on the final year. So significantly lower than ours, orders of magnitude lower than ours. Coastal GasLink, which is the pipeline that's feeding into that project, they pay an additional $21 million a year. So if you benchmark that against our current statutes, our pipeline, assuming a $14 billion pipeline, is going to be over $200 million a year in property taxes versus 21 on Coastal GasLink. So obviously this is a major barrier to our project. It puts us in a different competitive landscape when we're sort of burdening our own project with these high property taxes. This has always been a view, and if you go to slide 7, if I may, it's always been identified that property taxes would at some point have to be addressed for this project. Even in the producer-led model, if you remember right, they had the Municipal Alaska Pipeline Gas Advisory Board looking at PILT negotiating this. This has always been an issue that we have to address, and it feels like we are finally at the moment where it's come to a critical point. So with that, I'd like to hand over to Adam, unless there are other questions that we'd like to answer first.
Well, if we could pause here and just take some questions. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kissinger, I'm curious if one of the reasons that we've had a hard time coming to a PILT agreement or something similar for so long is because of the way that the taxing power is written in our Constitution, saying that it shall never be suspended or contracted away. Is that a potential impediment compared to these other jurisdictions such as Texas or elsewhere?
Yeah, Senator Myers, through the chair, well, certainly they did find a way to provide specific tax benefits to, you know, individual projects in each of those places. And all of those are directed at these capital intensive industrial sector projects. So whether that's a barrier in Alaska, I'll let Mark maybe opine on.
Madam Chair, it's Mark Bagage for the record. Senator, I don't think it's a barrier. It's been never the right time. What I mean by that is you've never had a project this close to a potential development. And so it seemed appropriate. Also, just to make sure folks know, I didn't say this at the beginning, but since January, we've been discussing and meeting with the mayors on a weekly basis on this issue. Because it has been in report after report over the many years, property tax issues in Alaska for a project like this is going to be an issue. Now we have a project, so we can see the finance component of it and say, okay, what's the number? In this case, it's equivalent to 2 mills. So that I wanted to – so it's not a constitutional. It's more of a timing of now it's time to have this conversation.
Okay.
Further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. In the producer-led project, my understanding is that the numbers that were discussed were $800 million to be set aside for community impact over 5 years, and then $700 million annually in property taxes. And under this project, as I understand it, it's zero set aside during the ramp-up phase, during the phase in which the project is being built, and then until you hit a BCF for 10 years, and then it's roughly $70 million per year. So that's a huge difference. Maybe you can explain why that's such a big difference.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Again, you know, the benchmarking demonstrates that these other jurisdictions, so taking the operating property tax first, you know, again, that they're an order of magnitude higher. And so for us to compete, the idea would be let's at least have a level playing field for the operating property taxes. When it comes to property taxes during construction, the first thing to know is that under current statutes, if AGDC is a participant in the project, is a joint venture member of the project, then there are no property taxes paid during construction. That's the current statutes. I would say, though, that there are going to be real impacts to the communities. We know that. We're having conversations with the mayors around that. And, you know, there will be a resolution to that.
Mark, yeah. If you want to add. Again, for the record, Madam Chair, Mark Bagage. Senator, I think when you see the revenue as they go through their document, and Glenn Farn, you'll have a little more explanation around this. But, you know, what's happened several years ago under a different model compared to this model, they're very different models in a certain way, and that is the risk factor to the state. And so I think once we go through the revenue pieces, you'll see some of that, and that may answer some of your question.
Senator Wilkowski, follow up.
I think the thing that I'm struggling with and many others are struggling with is how much of this is actually needed to make the project profitable. And so it comes down to, from my perspective, what's the project cost? What's going to be the tariff? What's going to be the rate of return for the producer, for the developer? And it's hard to evaluate this versus those other projects because I don't know what they're getting. I don't know what their local communities are getting. I don't know what kind of sales tax they might be generating. I don't know what kind of other maybe local business taxes they're generating. So it's hard for me to do an apples to apples comparison, but all I know is under this project, there's very little, and I have no idea whether this is a good deal or not.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mark Bagage, for the record, we would love to give you more detail. I'll be very frank with you all here. You know, we'd love to do some work in executive session with you because there's some proprietary information. You are a partner. We have to sell gas, meaning Glenn Farn, the state. And the more information you put on the record and the public on the financial condition means the buyers can push down the price, which means you get less margin. That's how it works. So if you want to have some more of that discussion, we're very open to that. But let me add this. That model was different. You had producers with their gas They have a different profit margin, where they take their money. You know this better than anybody, how they operate. So this is a different project. It's a developer that has a much lower rate of return requirement because it's not traded on the New York Stock Exchange and all those things, all these investors. It's a different ballgame. It has a lower rate of return needed versus the last one, which they were just pushing their gas through to sell the gas for cash flow. It's a different ballgame. So, but again, I would say, Senator, we agree that the more information you have is important, but you are also in another position as a partner in the project. You want to get the most best price you can when you sell it. And it'd be like any vendor in town saying, here's what I paid for it. Now I want to charge you X. Well, then I know what they paid. So I'm going to push you down on the price. That's what we're in here. So we have to be careful how we display and give you the information. We're going to give you everything we possibly can. There's no two ways. When you see the revenue stream and what you're going to hear from Glenn Farn in a few minutes, they'll give you even more detail. But I want to give you the practicality of how this, I mean, you know, you're not here asking the permanent fund on all their investments of $80 billion in every detail, but they do it on your behalf to get you the best rate of return. Because they have a process of ensuring they represent the state. In this case, you have a very similar situation. The difference is here, you actually are the final body, the board of directors, who have to make a decision on this one element. And again, you know, you'll hear from Glenn Farn in a moment on the details of some more information and then revenue. And then if there's still not satisfaction of the questions, we're happy to have those additional conversations. On top of that, I should have mentioned earlier, from the governor's liaisons, from the legislative piece of it, the person that I would ask you to keep contact with is Rachel Blysom, because she is the person on this project identified as deputy chief who will work on this project. I just want to make sure that's clear. So as you ask questions, we can answer them. I hope your staff can reach out to her as quickly as possible. She will get you what you need.
Further questions? Senator Klayman.
So, Senator, or I guess former Senator Begich, you propose this model that says because we've got a private investor instead of a publicly held corporation as the maker that their profit margins are different, that they can run things on a tighter and essentially a less profitable model to make this work. And I'm just wondering what business school preaches that, because I'm not familiar with any instance in which private enterprises want to make less profit than public enterprises.
No. Madam Chair, through the chair, that's not what I said. What I said is the Exxon model is different than this model. This model has a partner that requires a less of a rate of return than the corporations that were involved in the last deal.
Follow up,
Senator Klayman.
Which is the partner that requires a lower rate of return?
In this one, it's Glenn Farn, compared to their corporate partners of the last deal.
And
follow up, Senator Klayman.
So. This is news to me in any sort of business company that comes forward and say we have a smaller profit margin model. I'm just the premise that you're raising, Mr. Begich, I'm just raising questions about because if I see Glenn Farn sitting in front of me, I think they're here to make as much money as they can.
Through the chair.
I mean, maybe I'm missing something.
No, through the chair. Senator. Glenn Farn's going to walk through their process with you. But here's how it works in the business world. Someone who employs, between myself and my wife, 400 people in four different states in multiple businesses. A competitor is always looking for their edge. Margin is part of their edge. When you have certain companies that have fixed costs that are spread over a lot of property projects, big companies that say, you know what, BP, I'm not in the business anymore. I'm selling to Hillcorp. Smaller margin. Why? Because they're a smaller business model back then. They bought up BP's assets. Why? Because BP saw no more value in it because their margins were too high. They needed higher margins. I can go through business. Every business competes that way. You have certain things in a business you can compete on. Price of product, labor cost, insurance, and your margin. And if you can lower your margin and get volume, you might do that. I took a couple of businesses out myself doing that. I'm just telling you, everyone, absolutely, Glenn Farn's job in our partnership, their job is to get as much as they can. No question about that. But they also have to have some elasticity in their number because they've got to be careful that they don't knock themselves out of their own competition. They want to be the people developing. On our end, our job is to get the most affordable gas we can for our residents and the most revenue. So sometimes we compete against each other, but at the end of the day, their model as a business is a little different than some of the big companies because they have quarterly reports, shareholder demands, all kinds of different procedures. Matt?
Yeah, if I may, Senator Klayman through the chair, you can really see this change between the producers and the developer and this lower cost of capital. You can see this through the evolution of certain Wood Mackenzie reports. So in 2015, I think it was maybe 2016, when the producers stepped out of this project, they had Wood Mackenzie come in and they did a competitiveness analysis. And Wood Mackenzie concluded that this project was not very competitive at the time. And they identified as to why. And the main reason why was that we weren't using project finance. They also looked at the gas prices and they looked at some tax advantages of having it rolled under AGDC. But the big one was project finance. Why not use project finance? What you get with project finance, and for those of you that are unaware of what that is, it's non-recourse debt. It means that you take your project and instead of the sponsors financing it on their own balance sheets, they finance it on the basis of the contracts for that particular project. So in our case, it'll be the credit worthiness of the upstream suppliers and the strength of those contracts with Exxon and Hilcorp, et cetera, and the strength and the credit worthiness, especially of our downstream buyers. And it doesn't, there is no, if you default, there's no recourse back to the sponsors. So this is how all the LNG projects in the U.S. Gulf Coast were financed. When you do that, when you wrap your projects in these contracts, you don't just get the project finance without recourse. You get a lower cost of equity as well. And that's when you move from more of a speculative type investor that's going to be investing in your big, you know, international oil companies to more of like your retirement funds and other more conservative investors where they don't need, you know, they don't want exposure to a lot of risk and they don't need a huge return. They just want a nice nominal return. And that lower cost of capital is what allows this project to truly compete. That was the biggest step change that was made. When we did the WoodMac, the follow-up WoodMac analysis in 2022, not to be mistaken for the phase one that we did, I think, a couple years ago, but we did a new competitiveness analysis after we passed through our own economic stage gate. And in that, you can see they said, that's great job. You're now competitive because you did these things. And then they identified other things to work on. They also identified property tax as outside of cost overrun risk as the single biggest variable impacting the cost of supply on this project.
Follow up? Not to this point. All right. Next on in line, first of all, I want to welcome Senator Merrick, who has come to join us today. Senator Kawasaki, you were next on the list.
We're talking a little bit about the project financing and then how to that there's going to be less risk. I guess I kind of have a question about, I mean, aren't the investors expecting a return too? Why are these investors expecting less of a return or an equal return in this project?
Senator Kawasaki, yeah. Through the chair. It all has to do with exposure to risk. And so the better your contracts are. So right now, Glen Farne are focusing on getting 16 million out of the 20 million tons. Under long-term contract. That means for 20 years, the price, terms, et cetera, are already set. Having such a huge amount of your production under terms that are very predictable allows your investors then to count on a very predictable return. When you can count on a more predictable return, then you demand a lower cost of equity because you're not exposed to as much risk. And it's just sort of as simple as that.
Follow-up, Senator.
Madam Chair, if I can, this is Adam Presage with Glen Farne. If I can interject here, if that's permitted.
Yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just brief introduction to Adam Presage, President of Glen Farne, Alaska LNG. Met and spoke with each of you and appreciate the time to be back in front of you here today. Just to put some points on really confirmation of what Mark and Matt have presented to you. As the private sponsor here, the point that Matt makes about project finance is very critical and very different. And the model that we're describing, the model that Glenfarne operates in and other similar infrastructure investors is focused on infrastructure rates of return. And so when you look at Glenfarne, we are, to put it colloquially, we're an infrastructure player. That's very different from Conoco, Exxon, BP, Hillcorp, which are producers or commodity players. And so they put money at risk to go develop oil and gas resources and then sell that for the upside in the market. Glenfarne doesn't come into investments looking to take that kind of a risk. And so our cost of capital is lower and requires a lower return. And for example, the most important part of that is a lot of project finance, most project finance, you typically 70 to 80% of a project cost comes in the form of debt, just like a mortgage on a house. And so when we're talking about what kind of return does that require, it requires a fixed interest payment over a period of time. So it's very knowable and forecastable. The infrastructure investors who come in and provide the additional 20 or 30% in the form of equity, exactly as Matt said, they're typically retirement funds, pension funds, endowments, educational investment funds. And so they know, and the permanent fund is a great example of that. The permanent fund, their target returns are public and knowable, and they are forecastable. And so that's the same structure that Glenfarne intends to finance with for this project here, and it's very different from the prior iteration of the project. What that means is we need to achieve a certain threshold of return on the project. And in order to do that, we need to keep costs as low as we possibly can. So if you'll allow, Matt, if you can go to slide 8, and then I'll cede back to you because I think you, there we go. Ultimately, Glenfarne's goal on the pipeline is to develop the pipeline, construct it, and deliver gas to Alaskans as low cost and as quickly and safely as possible. Because we know the return and because we have an established economic model that we need to achieve, the result of adding additional costs on the project, the result of that is increasing the cost or the price of the product that is being sold from the project. In other words, this property tax is going to be paid for by the customers of the project. There isn't a massive amount of huge profits in this project for Glenfarne to achieve because of our project finance structure. So the additional cost of the property tax, by our estimates, would result in a 25% higher gas cost to the Alaskan customers when they buy from the pipeline. That has an impact on the energy bills of the customers of the utilities. It has an impact on the businesses and industrial firms that would require the gas or would look to be rebuilding or recommissioning with this gas. And it has an impact on any other facility that buys gas off of the pipeline.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki?
Thanks. I still had the follow-up. So a project that you've been involved in, I think, if you were there in 2017, so not that long ago, was going to be 75% of the LNG was going to be taken up by China. And China, Bank of China Limited and CIC Capital Corp, said that they would provide 75% of the funding of that $43 billion pipeline. They'd provide $32 billion. So, I mean, we're trying to suss out this project and try to compare it with all the other projects we've seen recently. How is that not economic? And then this one is economic if we do a couple things. And then I do have a question about risk because it was brought up too.
Yeah. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. I'd say that the
Mr. Kissinger for identify yourself
sorry,
for the
Matt
record.
Kissinger for the Thank record. You. Yeah. The state-led model, as you were just referring to, where we were over in specifically in China, where we got a lot of traction. A joint development agreement was achieved, non-binding, But in that, I can tell you there were a number of issues that were always in the forefront in those conversations. One was having a qualified developer in the project. They insisted that either one of the producers needed to come back in or we needed to find someone to develop the project other than AGDC, just of the view that AGDC probably didn't have the skills. And I think they were probably right in that assumption. But property tax was actually always one of the discussed items there because it does stand out when you do the modeling. And of course, they did do the modeling. It just does stand out because it has an impact of, and you'll see in the Department of Revenue slides, it has an impact of around 50 cents per MMBTU on your cost of LNG sold. Now, as Adam just mentioned, you pass the price on to your customers, but only where you can. On the LNG side, you cannot do that because you're not figuring out what your costs are and then selling your LNG at the cost. You're selling your LNG at what the market is, and you're just competing with other people in the market. And that market will dictate your price, and then you need to see, is there enough room between that price and where our costs are and everything else to make this project work? This project has never worked, and for a number of reasons. It is economic just on the basis of flat numbers, but you have to take certain barriers out of the way, and you have to keep other barriers from being thrown up. And property taxes, as identified back in 2015-16, have always been a barrier. It's always been understood that this would have to be addressed.
So,
follow up, last one, Senator Kawasaki.
And this is about the risk. You keep mentioning sort of this risk of cost overruns. We've got that. We've gathered that. And then the cost of gas is the other risk. The change in political environment and change of climate. I think you've got South Korea that's committed to buying. You've got a couple other Asian countries that may or may not buy. But a lot of that is contingent upon, it's contingent upon the $30 billion loan guarantee. It's contingent upon sort of like where President Trump is. And isn't that risk being calculated somewhere? Won't that be part of the risk that you know, we're saying we're going to assume by not taxing through property?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I would just point out, you know, the support that this project has actually gotten even before the Trump administration. So throughout the Biden administration, we had several lawsuits that were filed. The Biden administration defended this project in those lawsuits. Defended it with great enthusiasm and successfully. The conversations that we had in Japan that included the ambassador to Japan, Rahm Emanuel, appointed by Biden, a big proponent of the project, an unwavering supporter and proponent of the project. And so, you know, while President Trump did come in and make this a real priority, the project sits on its own merits. It reduces CO2 emissions by 70 million tons per annum by displacing coal in Asia. And if you don't believe in that theory, watch what happens with Qatar being down. Watch how quickly Asian countries pivot back to coal to replace LNG. Just watch it in Taiwan. They're already starting. So we do eliminate 70 million. Put 70 million tons per annum into perspective. That is equivalent to taking one out of every five cars off the American road. So it's a huge benefit to the climate, for one thing. Obviously, it's a huge benefit to the economy of Alaska, but also to the security of the Pacific region. You have a maritime industry that is moving towards LNG as their chief fuel, and our own maritime fleet that would be supporting us in time of conflict is more and more going to be fueled by LNG, not just the Navy fleet, but the merchant marine fleet. So, you know, the value of this or the benefits of this project cross party lines. They really, the presence of Senator Begich sitting here tells you.
Thanks.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with that last statement. Thank you, Mr. Kissinger. And I think there's a high likelihood this line will be completed during a Democratic presidency. I wanted to go back to something you mentioned before, has to do with risk. You talked about cost overrun risk, and you said it's being borne by the developer. I just want to make sure that that is actually the case, that the rate payers for at least a portion of the risk in primarily in South Central are not being asked to bear that. So can you or Mr. Prestige confirm that the rate payers through, you know, NSTAR and Chugach are not being asked as a part of their contracts to assume any cost overrun risk?
Senator Dunbar, I'd like to pass to Adam for that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Adam Prestige, Glen Farm for the record. That is confirmed, Senator Dunbar. And the reason you can know that and be confident in that and not just take my word for it is that our customers, Chugach, NSTAR, others, will have long-term gas sales contracts that they will sign, and they will have a price that is a designated price that will run for the entire multi-decade term of the contract. That contract will then be delivered to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, whose one of their primary jobs is to protect the ratepayers from the type of concern that you're articulating. So the entire model here is built around the developer taking cost overrun risk. That is inherent to being a project developer in a non-recourse project of this type. And so very emphatically, the risk of cost overruns is not only not on the ratepayers of Alaska, it's also not on the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska's role or participation in the project right now does not require the state to put in another dollar if it doesn't want to, and it doesn't risk a dollar being lost from the state. So that is very much the model, and we can firmly commit that Glen Farm and our investors and our lenders are the ones who wear the risk of cost overruns.
Follow up,
Senator Dunbar.
I'll just say, thank you, Mr. Prestige. I agree with your description of what RCA's role is, and I'm just glad to hear that the contracts, the long-term contracts, won't include any cost overrun risk. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that too. And just to maybe verify, and would you support inclusion of provisions in the bill that we passed that any property tax cuts must be passed on to consumers in the form of lower gas prices, and also a provision that no cost overruns will be passed on to ratepayers?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, if you're asking if we would consider it, certainly happy to take a look at language and consider it. I mean, that the two things you're describing are characteristics of how this project is being set up, and so we can look at language.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
What would you need to look at? You just said on the record that you support both of those things. What if we just put pretty much that in the statute? No cost overruns passed on to ratepayers, and any property tax cuts must be passed on to consumers in the form of lower rate gas prices. We've done that in the past. I'll get those amendments drafted. You're okay with that?
Senator Wilikowski, as you said, you asked if I'd consider it or if we consider it, and I'm telling you we'd consider it.
Get it drafted.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at this slide, looking at this slide directly in front of us, saying that we're looking at potentially dropping the price by about 25%, which sounds very attractive. But I'm also looking at later on in the presentation here, what we were given, it looks more like a 10% drop. So I'm curious where that numbers come from.
Yeah, Senator Myers, through the chair, this is really just the difference between looking at the full phase two, so fully flowing LNG project, versus the phase one where you just have Alaska in-state demand being met. So what Adam has presented here with 25% lower, that is if you're looking at it just as phase one, just in-state deliveries, whereas what the Department of Revenue is going to show you is the full build-out project.
Okay. Yeah.
Further questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you. I got one more. So, Mr. Kissinger, you made a very valid point that in order to be competitive, we got to be competitive with whatever the market rate is. What is your market price assumption for the exports, and where are you getting those numbers?
Senator Myers, through the chair, obviously there are confidential negotiations going on right now. So for me to go out and place exactly where we view price versus, you know, others, I don't want to conflict with anything that I'm saying to any of the customers. But if you look at how different contracts are priced, let's think of it this way. There's Gulf of Mexico contracts. Henry Hub is, if you look at the forward base, it's around $4, $4 to $5. By the time you add your fuel, because you have to, you pay your Henry Hub price, but you also pay 15% more for the fuel. So let's just round that to $5 for easy math. $5 for your Henry Hub plus $2.50 for liquefaction. You can look that up. It's pretty much standard across those projects, somewhere in the mid two range. So $5 to buy it, $2.50 to liquefy it, and it's about $2.50 to move it shipping from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Asia. So U.S. Gulf Coast LNG landing in Asia is pricing somewhere around $10. $10 is a good number to use as your hurdle. If you're looking at Brent-priced contracts, and the nice thing about us in Alaska, we have a lot of flexibility. So in the U.S. Gulf Coast, they have to price on Henry Hub. But we have flexibility because of the way this is mostly an infrastructure project as opposed to a commodity project. Brent is usually on a slope of Brent. And that what that means is like 13% Brent. So if Brent crude is priced at $100, then 13% Brent would be $13. And a lot of those are hovering somewhere between 12, 13, 14% that are published out there that you can look up online. So somewhere in, you know, if you're thinking $70 to $80 Brent, you again get back to that kind of $10 range. So if you're looking at the long-term market, $10 is a pretty decent assumption.
Okay. Thank you.
Any additional questions? Okay. I have one. So, you know, on this slide, and you refer to property tax as a abatement as kind of normal. You know, right now we have a refinery down in Nikiski, and they're about to do a turnaround, a maintenance turnaround in April. And so this is what they're putting out. It's been 3 years since their last one. It's 4 to 6 weeks of maintenance, repairs, and upgrades to the facility. Okay, so what? This starts the second week in April and goes almost to the end of May. Over that 4 to 6 weeks, expect between 1,500 and 2,000 incoming non-local workers here. Many are coming from Alaska locations, but about 1,000 are out-of-staters. Traffic patterns will change. There will be no open hotel, motel rooms without a reservation. Any and all of our normal food shopping usually gets crazy. They do this about every 3 years. Let's see, where was I? Oh, this turnaround affects about 100 square miles of our lives. These men and women work 12-hour shifts 24-7 for close to 3 weeks. There are large buses running close to 24 hours a day. Watch for them. We will have an increase of 18-wheeler traffic also. Please give yourself extra time as you travel to and from work, 5 to 8 in the morning or 6 to 8:30 at night. This is sort of long, but I do feel folks need to pay attention. So that's kind of a picture. It was like one industrial complex in the area where, in one area where you're planning to put in some infrastructure and the impact on the community. But at this time, they will have property taxes. They will have bed taxes. They will have sales taxes to help with this, to cover the impact on the community. This is very much what it will be far worse, actually, in Fairbanks and for a much longer period of time. So it's no small thing. And when you're talking about property tax abatement, the bill goes further than that. It talks about sales taxes and bed taxes. And what are you offering to the communities that you're going to impact, the Alaskans who you're going to impact?
Madam Chair, Mark Beggs for the record. I'll also ask Adam to add to this. But first off, you know, the project will have, there's no two ways about it, you're going to have impacts. That's why we're having conversations with the mayors. We've had since January. And as you've already seen, the Mat-Su Borough has passed a resolution. They've gone through their process of support of the project with some tweaks they'd like to see. And we believe, as we continue with the mayors over the next couple of weeks, we'll see some of those issues and resolve them with them. It's been, in my opinion, going very well with them in the conversations. Is there a tug of war on certain things? Sure. But at the end of the day, I think the company, and we'll let Adam speak for that, recognizes there is impact. But at the same time, we have to recognize the long-term benefit to the state. It's a project that everyone, I bet if I ask, put this all aside, support the project of an idea of a gas line. Monetize our natural resources for the best of this community and the state. So those conversations with the local communities are happening and will continue to happen until we resolve some of their issues. And we were on the phone with the Denali mayor today, and we feel very confident that we're moving forward with resolution to their issues. So we recognize that, and that's why we're in conversations. On top of that, again, I'm going to ask Adam to this. They will bring a wealth of resources from medical to road repair, all kinds of things. They're going to make it part of their project. Let me pause if I can, Madam Chair, and ask Adam to respond to that.
Mr. Prestige?
Madam Chair, Adam Prestige, for the record, I agree with everything that Mark Begich has said. First and foremost, we recognize that there will be impacts, and that's an important part of what we are discussing with the mayors and will continue to be. That's that we need to have them feeling comfortable with the issues that you just articulated and feeling comfortable that the communities will be taken care of. That's important to recognize that effort that we're putting in, because under the current property tax structure, there is no payment required or no tax during construction. And so particularly when you look at some of the North Slope Borough and the Kenai Borough, where there are large facilities that will be built in phase two, you wouldn't see any revenue coming off of this project until the LNG facility is completed in mid 2031. And so we are open and looking and intending to accelerate that in order to compensate for some of the impacts. I agree with what Mark has said. First and foremost, the project will have many of its own services, travel and transportation, EMS, doctors in the camps, et cetera. And also, if there's any kind of impacts on the roads existing infrastructure that's interrupted, those will be repaired and restored at the project's cost. And so a lot of those impacts are already going to be mitigated just by the design of the project itself.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, did you have further presentation, or should we go to the Department of Revenue?
Chair Geisel, I'll just check with Adam and see if he'd like to talk about slide 9 before we move on. Adam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Adam Prestige, for the record. We've covered most of the items on this slide, but what I do want to reiterate is, yes, there's a massive benefit to financing this project with project finance. The benefit of that is a more affordable project and lower cost gas for Alaskans. That's achievable because project finance requires stable revenues with low risk, and putting in place a PILT program that is not subject to long going litigation over property tax or an unforecastable revenue line. Putting in place a PILT program creates more certainty and lower risk for the project. And so that's one more benefit here.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this slide, it says Alaska's current 2 mil property tax rate, an order of magnitude higher. Is that supposed to say 20 mil? Because isn't 2 mil what you're asking for, and 20 mil is what you say is currently uncompetitive? And then the question I want to sort of hang out there for you, and particularly for the Department of Revenue, is if we're going from 20 mils to 2 mils, how do we know that's the right number? Does this project tip into profitability at 10 mils? At 8 mils? What is the real evidence that 2 is the number, not 14, for example?
Senator Dunbar, I'll respond. Ed, this is Adam Preston for the record, and then I'll allow Mark to make a comment as well. I think you've identified a typo, and apologies. We'll get that corrected and resubmitted. That's an important typo. The 2 mil property tax rate does come from a survey of other projects from recommendations from Gaffney Klein and Woodmac. And so I will leave that to the Department of Revenue or AGDC to address those prior studies.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Follow up, Senator Dunbar?
No, thank you.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the Chair, I just want to know, if this bill doesn't pass, is there a realistic path forward at all?
Madam Chair, Mark Bakich for the record. I'll ask Adam also to respond. It makes it more difficult. Because what you end up with is you're dealing with a marginal project from the get-go. That's why it hasn't been done in 40 years. So everything that you're hearing today, from the project financing to this item, several other things, they're trying to compress the risk, and even though you're working on a pretty slim margin at the same time. So it puts it, it makes it more difficult. And I'll let Adam, as the developer, respond. But I can tell you, based on what I know.
Hello.
I believe Mr. Prestige wanted to speak.
Okay.
Did you wish to
yes,
respond?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Adam Prestige. It makes the project more difficult because it makes the gas more expensive. That's contrary to our primary objective on the pipeline. If that becomes too expensive to where it's unpalatable for the utilities or for the RCA, we're really going to have to take a look at how this project is going to get done in a different way. And so I think it creates an incredible amount of uncertainty around the project. And also has a chilling effect on outside stakeholders, investors and lenders who are looking at the state of Alaska and whether it is a reliable place to invest in building projects.
Follow up, Senator Rauscher.
Just a quick comment. It just worries me that we wouldn't be able to afford to play anymore. And that's what worries me about it if we don't pass this in some form. So appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rauscher. Senator Kawasaki.
Yes, and we've heard this a couple times now, and I don't care who wants to respond to it, but we heard that the project sits on its own merit. We heard before coming down to this legislative session that we would have FID. And then a month later, we were told it's going to be March. Today's March 30th. Tomorrow's the end of the month. I'm just curious, you know, we're getting this right now, and I don't want to be the one that looks like I'm standing in the way of a big gas line. Why was this not discussed prior to this point in time?
Senator Kawasaki, if I may, I want to remind Adam Prestige for the record. I want to remind that Glen Farm came into ownership of the project almost exactly 1 year ago. And in that period of time, we have done a tremendous amount of work and accelerated this project, I think it's safe to say, further than it ever has been before. We commissioned Worley, the largest and best engineering firm in the world, to conduct a re-engineering and a repricing of the project that was concluded on time in December. First, it would have been imprudent of us to be presenting a property tax bill without having completed that re-engineering and that repricing. And so really just taking, you know, proper development in sequence, that needed to be completed before we could get into this. In addition to that, we've spent time working with the mayors. And as any of you can imagine, working with five municipalities to make sure that everyone is getting what they need, takes time, and we've been meeting with them on a weekly basis since January to make sure that everyone feels comfortable with what's going forward. And frankly, we haven't wanted to rush that component of the discussions.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you make the point here that we need to be competitive. Lowering our rate makes us competitive. Excuse me. Gaffney Klein has given us some similar presentations talking about different projects around the world. Initially, when this concept first went out a few months ago, the governor was talking about dropping the property taxes from 20 mils down to 2 mils. part of your presentation here, part of what Gaffney Klein has told us is that it's common to put a time limit on that, 10, 12, 15 years, something like that. Why aren't we talking about simply doing a time-limited drop of the mill rate rather than this entirely new type of tax?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Adam to respond, but let me first say this. First thing is they're negotiating long-term deals, so you got to have some certainty in that period of time. And sometimes it's 20. I think the contract period is 30, 20?
In-state 30, in-state, out-of-state 20.
So you want to be careful about that window. But let me just pause and ask Adam, then I'll probably add some additional. Adam?
Mr. Prestige.
Madam Chair, Adam Prestige for the record, Senator Myers. When you ask what does it take to make a project competitive, yes, first and foremost is price, but very close behind that is certainty and a confidence by customers that the product is going to show up when they're expecting it to show up. So that means certainty that the project will be completed and supported and carried through the completion of construction, and also a confidence and a certainty that the project won't be subject to large volatility and major changes during the operational phase of the project. And so when you look at this, why we structured it this way, first of all, the volumetric tax is very easy for anyone to look at and forecast and calculate. We will simply measure the amount of gas that passed through the pipeline. And there's a number of cents per unit of gas, super easy to calculate for anyone. A property tax based on mill rates depends on the property value. And as we know from the history of litigation on TAPs, that can be a huge spectrum of what, or a huge range of what that property value can be, and it can be heavily litigated. And so you get into two problems there. You get into a problem with the price, and you get into a problem of certainty and the possible interruption or cost increases during operations.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Getting back to Senator Dunbar's question a little bit, as you know, we have a constitutional obligation to get the maximum benefit for the resource. I'd be okay with two mills, quite frankly, me personally, if you showed me that this project doesn't happen unless it's two mills. But I have nothing to base that on, and none of us have anything to base that on. Should I just take your word? What if it's three mills? What if it's four mills? What if it's six mills? We have nothing to base that on. And so how do we reconcile that? And I'm just telling you, I'm not signing a non-disclosure agreement. And I know a lot of legislators share that as well. I'm just not doing it personally. So how do we get to that point where there's a comfort level that we're not pushing $700 million to $1 billion over to you without some assurances that that's absolutely necessary?
Mark Baker.
Senator Wilkowski, please. Thank you. Thanks, Mark. Madam Chair, this is Adam Prestige for the record. Senator Wilkowski, I'm going to take this opportunity just to talk about something that it's very important, and it is the concept of information transparency. And I know that's a theme that's come up in a lot of our conversations here. I can tell you that one of Glen Farms' core values is integrity. We have five core values, and integrity is one of them. We talk about it all the time. We make decisions based on that. And I do think that transparency and communication is part of that integrity value. And I hope that the way that we've interacted with you over the last year in this project, you've recognized our efforts to be accessible, to be communicative, to answer questions, and to be transparent with you.
Madam Chair.
So again.
Go ahead, Adam. Sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Prestige, thanks. Please continue.
Thank you. We had a discussion earlier about the competitive nature of this of the markets and of information being shared in competitive markets. And I agree with everything that Mark said. If we're out there publicly sharing our costs, our interest, our return, our rates of return, it is a guarantee that the contractors and suppliers who are bidding and selling into this project will use those numbers to calculate the highest possible numbers that they can charge to us. And on the other side of the infrastructure, it is a guaranteed outcome that as soon as we start publishing those numbers, our LNG buyers are going to use their very sophisticated analysis to back calculate what is the lowest possible number that they can bid us down to, and that will be their negotiating benchmark. It will put the project at a severe disadvantage to put those numbers out into the public, which ultimately lowers the project's negotiating leverage. Is going to result in a higher gas cost, a higher, more expensive project. So what do we do about that? Because I know it's an issue and it doesn't solve your problem, Senator Wilikowski. I want to talk about a couple of things. First, the Department of Revenue will walk through some nice sophisticated modeling and on this project. The assumptions that go into the Department of Revenue's model are strong assumptions based on engineering by top firms, good analysis, good mathematics that's gone into those calculations. And I can tell you that, you know, Glenn Farn thinks that those, we agree, we view those as reasonable, defensible estimates and calculations. In addition, in terms of transparency, this legislature put in place a transparency regime for this project when it set up AGDC. And so I want to remind the committee that we have AGDC as our joint venture partner on this project. We have, not only do we have a quarterly board meeting, we have monthly development meetings, we have weekly meetings, we talk every day. The AGDC receives copies of our contracts, has the opportunity to review and comment on contracts before they're even issued to counterparties, and so that transparency is there. In addition, the 8-Star board has an independent board member, Janet Weiss, the former president of BP Alaska, who is not beholden to Glen Farm, not beholden to AGDC. She's an independent board member there in the interest of the project and the citizens. Beyond that, beyond our disclosure obligations to AGDC, AGDC itself also has a board comprised of department heads and appointed private citizens, providing another layer of oversight on top of the project. And so I do want to make clear that we are committed to being as transparent as we can without actually doing what we think would injure the project.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
So I deal a little bit in settlement negotiations in my lifetime, and I know that parties put out offers that sometimes are higher or lower than what they would expect the final result to be. But what you're saying is 6 cents is it. Like this offer, this bill that's in front of us is it. This is the last best final offer that you can do. We can't change anything in it. That's what I'm hearing you saying.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, Adam Press, for the record, we've put forward a proposal that we think is in the best interest of the project. And it comes to this committee after months of discussion and review with the 5 borough mayors who would be signed on to this bill or to this tax.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Begich.
Madam Chair, Mark Begich for the record. Senator, we would not have a problem. We hear you on the NDAs. Then have an LBNA meeting with an executive session. You know, when you do settlements, they're not in public. You don't do those negotiations. And this is the single largest project any legislature will have done or will be probably dealing with. If you were on the local assembly, you would have an executive session on issues that would impact the financial well-being of the city. The decisions you make and the information, some of it that you're asking, as Adam's laid out, could have a negative impact on the rate of return that the state will receive and their interest in this project. So I would implore you, as we have asked before, have an executive session, have some more of these questions in more detail, because it is in the best interest as you all are the board of directors. And it would make sense to want to ask these questions so you don't jeopardize the negotiating position of your interest that AGDC represents and Glen Farn is trying to do on contracts. It's just, you would always do that. You don't care if you're a massive board. You would have a board meeting without the public sitting in there to talk about these things. We can give you so much. You're here from the revenue, and as you heard from Adam, he's pretty comfortable with the estimations and the calculations they have used here to derive the information you're going to see here. Very comfortable with that. But I would implore you, like anyone would do in your interest, as the state of Alaska representatives, that having an executive session might get you some additional information that cannot be public.
While I appreciate those comments, I will also share with you that this legislature understands the responsibility we have. This is a generational decision we're making. And the bill before us that we're discussing today, 280, will likely change because we have the ability to do that. We've made decisions before, financial decisions related to natural gas in Cook Inlet. And one of those decisions was an error. We repealed that decision. So we can't bind future legislatures. Finances may change. So you're talking about certainty and stability. Well, we're going to be doing that. We're going to be looking at that. And I can't promise that things won't change going down the road because we're here to look after the best interests of Alaskans. So I appreciate you being here today. Are there further questions from committee members? Senator Klayman, and then we're going to go to poor Mr. Stickle, who is waiting now for a second meeting. But Senator Klayman.
I continue to be challenged by the lack of information that we have for what is involved in the deal. And the example, we have settlements that are negotiated confidentially. The negotiation itself is confidential, but when we approve the settlement, that figure is in front of us. And we can get people and say, how did you come to this number? Why do you think that was reasonable? Did we undersettle or oversettle? Does it seem to be a fair settle? But we actually can talk about the dollar value of that settlement in a public place. And so I continue to be challenged. I mean, even if we just talk about the estimated cost, and I currently gather there was a more recent estimate of the cost of building the project that's within the last year and a half, we've never seen it. And we haven't had a chance to go through that in detail and see the line items and stuff. And certainly if I were on a corporate board and asked to invest, I would get to see that estimate. I would get to see all the details. And I think this is part of the challenge is we're publicly elected folks. Even if we went into a confidential meeting with the not Labor and Commerce, but with the other committee, if we went in that committee meeting and got confidential information, the public said, what did you find out? And the answer is, we can't tell you. That doesn't give us the public process the public would want before we make this kind of decision. And I continue to be challenged by what's the real information we're trying to rely on to make a decision that's quite serious. I don't underestimate the magnitude of the project if it works, but I also I don't think I understate the lack of information we're presented here to work with.
Senator Klayman, Wood Mackenzie did a report in 2024. We are attempting to request their presence to present the 2024 study. So more information.
I had the impression it was a 25 estimate.
I know about one in 2024. Was there one in 2025, Mr. Kissinger?
Chair Giesel, we know that the phase one feed was completed in 2025. So that's the number that is being held, you know, quite confidential.
So for clarification, that was done by Wood Mac.
No, clarification, that was done by Worley under contract to Glenfarne. So that was Glenfarne led.
And of course it was confidential.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Wood Mackenzie has done estimates as well.
Right.
The assumptions we have questions about.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us. Mr. Prestige, thank you for joining us via Zoom. Mr. Kissinger, Mr. Begich, thank you. So now, with great expectation.
There's 15 minutes to spare.
Mr. Dan Stickle, who is the Chief Economist, Tax Division, Department of Revenue. Clearly, we will not get completely through the presentation, but fortunately, Mr. Stickle lives here, so he's available to us.
Maybe he doesn't feel so fortunate.
Yes, perhaps not. Welcome, Mr. Stickle. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. As you noted, Madam Chair, obviously not going to get through the entire presentation today. Happy to come back at a future date to finish it. I can just start going through the slides, or if there's any particular section you'd like to start with, we could jump to that for the committee's benefit.
Committee members, I don't see any particular choice, so I would say start at the beginning.
Thank you. All right. So the first nine slides were the slides from Glen Farm that we'd inserted into the presentation. I'm going to start with slide 11, which is a little bit of background on property tax, just to give kind of some context for the bill. So the state levies a property tax on all oil and gas property in the state. This is any property for exploration, production, and pipeline transportation of oil and gas. It's a 20 mils or 2% tax rate. We centrally assess that in Department of Revenue. And our Department of Revenue assessment is what's used for both the state's property tax application as well as municipal property taxes. And any municipal property taxes are allowed as a credit against the state tax. So regardless of what the municipal tax rate is for all oil and gas property in the state, the burden is 20 mils or 2% of assessed value. Under current law, LNG plants are exempt from the state level property tax. However, the municipal property tax does apply. And that's an important consideration for that component of the AK LNG project.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, going back to the 20 mils, I believe we heard the North Slope Borough levies 18.5, whereas Kenai Borough is 7. Perhaps you could correct those numbers.
Chair Giesel, yes. So I believe it's 17.99 for North Slope Borough. And yeah, around, I don't have the exact numbers at the top of my head. I do have someone online who could provide those exact numbers if you'd like. But the key concept here is that those municipal taxes are allowed as a credit against the state tax. The municipalities have to apply the same tax rate to oil and gas property as they apply to all other property that they apply property tax to. And the total burden outside of these LNG plants, the total burden is the 2% or 20 mils.
Very good. Thank you.
And so that just provided a little bit of that's the tax that we're talking about suspending here for the AKLNG project. So what does the proposed legislation do? On slide 13, we've talked a little bit about this already from Glen Farm and AGDC. So this bill would replace that state and local property tax for the AKLNG project with the alternative volumetric tax. It would exempt it entirely and during a 10-year ramp-up period of up to 10 years, and then it would apply that volumetric tax once the full LNG project is online. And again, the volumetric tax at 2 mils is roughly, the volumetric tax at the 6 cents is roughly equivalent to 2 mils based on what the estimate of the capital cost for the project was.
Very good, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, I just had a question just to back up this a little bit. But so what is the actual cost, or what is the actual valuation of what the proposed line is supposed to be? And if it's in the presentation, sorry, I missed it.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, yes, we do have that information coming up. We are using an assumption of a total construction cost for the project in real 2026 dollars of $46.2 billion. That is based on a 2023 estimate that was provided to us by AGDC and has been scaled up to 2026 based on inflation.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
Is the cost of construction an actual value for the pipeline or for this whole the project itself? I'm just thinking, so you have a house that gets built, the construction cost for the house is not the actual value of the house, right? Are we assuming that will be the value when at the 2026 base year?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. So typically the assessed value of the pipeline would be a little different than the construction cost. There's a depreciation that takes place there. There's also inflation to value over time. We're assuming that those variables roughly cancel out. And so, yes, the construction cost roughly becomes the assessed value that we're assuming.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki.
So, I mean, we're anticipating man camps. We're anticipating other facilities. We're anticipating other roads and things like that. Aren't those considered part of the – or where wouldn't those be included in the property tax at the 20 mil rate, even if it's a temporarily constructed road or a pad, for instance, a man camp?
Sure, Senator Kawasaki through the chair, and we're getting a little outside of my expertise on exactly where we draw the line between what constitutes taxable property for the property tax versus what would be exempted under this bill, versus what would be taxable property that is not considered an oil and gas piece of property. We do have someone from Department of Law online who could speak to those detailed questions if desired.
Would you be interested in that, Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, I think so. Just to clarify exactly what we're talking about.
All right.
To start.
I see Ryan Farnsworth, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. Mr. Farnsworth?
Yes, I'm on.
Great. Did you hear Senator Kawasaki's question, or should he repeat it?
He should repeat it. That'd be great.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, sir. My question had to deal with the actual property taxes at the state and local levels, and of course, for an LNG project. So if you've got like a man camp, you have a temporarily built road, you've got facilities, things like that, are those considered part of the exempted properties?
Thank you. Through the chair, yes, I would say that yes, they are if they're contributed by contract. If there's a contract that shows how it's related to the property, there's a procedure, or there will be a procedure where DOR will consider whether a property should be added to the kind of the aggregate property for the project.
And then
follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
And would that include like pipeline storage yards and those types of related facilities? And then since it also includes things like sales taxes, if a person were to buy a vehicle in a place with a sales tax and then be exempted, would that be included in what we're talking about in this proposed legislation?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, the laydown yard, yeah, would probably be exempted if contributed in some fashion by contract, but the personal vehicles purchased by employees and construction workers would not be exempted from the same.
So just to clarify, the vehicles that are purchased by the contractors or the organization itself, the Alaska LNG, would be taxed or would not be taxed?
Which are we talking about, property tax?
No, I'm sorry. So to clarify, Madam Chair, the bill would talks about all different types of taxes and sort of a tax holiday system. Would all of the vehicles that are bought by AKLNG or the AKLNG affiliated project be exempted from those local taxes, for instance, for sales, if there was a sales tax in a particular region?
Yes, I would say that those probably are exempted from the tax, although that line could be defined, I think, in regulation from DOR.
Thank you. Senator Klayman.
Going back to the proposed line value of $46.2 billion in terms of the gas line, is that just the gas line, or does that include the plant at the north end as well as the liquefaction facility at the south end?
Sure, Senator Klayman through the chair again, Dan Stickle for the record. So that is our baseline assumption for the entire project construction cost, and that comes from we have a detailed two-page kind of summary of state and local benefits from the project that I believe we've provided to the committee. If not, we will, and that is the source of that number.
Thank you.
All right. I believe we can move on to the next slide, which would be 14.
All right, moving on to slide 14. So After exempting from the property taxes, the bill starts with a defined ramp-up period, and that ramp-up period exempts the project for the earlier of 10 years of commercial operations or the point at which the project's throughput exceeds 1 billion cubic feet of gas per day. And so essentially, that 1 billion cubic feet of gas is when the full AKLNG project comes online. So once there is a train of AKLNG, it's expected that that ramp-up period would end. And at that time, the alternative volumetric tax is 6 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of gas throughput in the pipeline, and that 6 cents increases by 1% annually for each year thereafter into perpetuity. The 6 cent tax is shared. It would be allocated over the entire project, including the treatment plant, pipeline, and LNG export facility. For the allocation of the project within municipalities, the municipalities would levy the tax and receive the full share of the allocation for their municipalities. The state would receive and levy the tax for that portion of the pipeline falling in the unorganized borough.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ask a clarifying question about 1% of what exactly? 1% of 6 cents is very different than 1% equal to 1 mil of the value of the project. So which 1% are we talking about?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, so it would be a 1% of the 6 cents. So in year two, it would be $6.06, and then an additional 1% increase in that rate in the third year and so on.
Okay. So that's an incredibly small number then, right? Unless I misheard you. So 1% of the 6 cents is 0.0606.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, that's how the math would work. So thus in year 10, the rate would be 6.56 cents per 1,000 cubic feet.
Okay.
Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That just seems like a very, very minuscule increase.
It does leave one speechless, I have to
admit. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions on this page? Seeing none, we can go on.
All right. So, again, Dan Stickle for the record. The next section of the presentation walks through our analysis for the fiscal note. Starting with slide 16, so in putting together the revenue section of the fiscal note, we had some questions about exactly how to show this in the fiscal note. If we assume that the project goes forward regardless of tax relief, then obviously this bill would result in lower state revenue. However, the assumption that's embedded into the fiscal note is that the project would not go forward under the current law, and so the fiscal note does show the revenue as a positive revenue to the state. The fiscal note shows the state's share only of the alternative volumetric tax revenue under our baseline scenario. The state receives about 12% of that total tax. The rest would go to municipalities. And due to fiscal note conventions, we're not showing other state revenues like production tax, royalty, et cetera. In the fiscal note itself, we do have those in the supplemental document that we've provided.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that I've seen a fiscal note that operates under those kind of assumptions, but what it means, I think, is if we were to adjust this number, say we went to 0.08 or 0.09, you would then supply us with another positive fiscal note, correct, that increased it by that amount?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, most likely, yes.
Okay. Until some point, at what point would you estimate that the project no longer occurs?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I can't answer that question right now.
Yeah, neither can we. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Did you create a model to determine how to get that 6 cent number?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we did not in Department of Revenue necessarily. We have done modeling of the project consistently over the years, and a roughly 2 mils tax rate has frequently been discussed as part of that modeling in consultation with AGDC.
Well, Senator Wilikowski,
what is the estimated rate of return to the to the developer with this 6 cent per 1,000 cubic feet?
Sure. Senator Bilikowski through the chair. So we don't have access to the detailed financial information to calculate a rate of return. What we do for our modeling purposes is we assume a 10% rate of return, and then we allow sensitivity analysis with a 7.5 or 15% rate of return. And so all of the modeling later on in the presentation is based on the assumption that there would be a 10% rate of return to the developer.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Is that the standard rate of return in these in LNG lines and LNG export facilities?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. So that's a longstanding assumption that's been developed in consultation with AGDC.
Further questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, just are we able to look at those sensitivity graphs? Is that something that we can look at?
Senator Kawasaki through the chair, yes. So okay. Later on in the presentation, I have some examples of some sensitivity, and we're happy to run additional sensitivities. Great. And we've presented that kind of with the acknowledgement that the detailed assumptions of the project are not publicly known. And so we use our baseline assumptions and then allow to vary key assumptions and see how that impacts results.
Thank you.
All right, I'll let you go on to the next slide.
All right, so slide 17, and I spoke to this again just to note that the fiscal note itself is only looking at the revenue impact of the alternative volumetric tax to the state in isolation. And so we've provided supplemental documents and modeling that provide a more holistic picture of the project and associated revenues.
Thank you. For the public, I know that probably the public doesn't look at the fiscal notes much, but I'm struck by the fact that really no revenue is assumed until 2031, and at that point it's indeterminate, which I appreciate. This was a second fiscal note that you gave us. Previously, there had been profit indicated there at 2031 for the state. Change in revenue was positive. So I appreciate that you made it indeterminate, not forecasting what income we would expect.
Okay, Chair Geisel, I apologize. I do not have the indeterminate fiscal note in front of me.
Okay.
The version that I'm looking at does have numbers on it, which will align with the next slide of the presentation.
The fiscal note I'm looking at is, let me turn to the front page of it, was dated 3/24, so March 24th. So I'll let you proceed.
All right. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle, and apologies for not having that fiscal note in front of me. Slide 18 shows a table of our estimated revenues from the alternative volumetric tax by fiscal year for the next 10 years. So this includes the fiscal note, which goes through fiscal year 2032, and then some additional years of the table to show what the revenue would be to the state and municipalities once the project is at full operations. Fiscal years 31 through 33 represent a ramp up. So 31 would be the first fiscal year where the project exceeds the 1 billion cubic feet per day of throughput and pays the alternative volumetric tax. And then fiscal 34 would be the first year that represents full throughput of the 3.5 billion cubic feet per day expected throughput. So at full operations, the state would receive about $9 million per year from the new tax, and municipalities would receive about $64 to $65 million per year.
Senator Wilkowski, did I see a hand?
I did. Yes, you did. What would be the, in year 2035 and 36, what would be the revenue to the local communities and the state if we didn't adopt this? In other words, if we just kept status quo.
Senator Wilikowski through the chair, so it would be higher. I don't have the year-by-year breakout of the current law. I do have those numbers by the municipalities, so it would be. A little under $500 million. And then I do have another document here that provides totals through calendar year 2042. Through calendar year 2042, without the tax relief and assuming the project goes forward, the local tax would be about $5.7 billion. And then under this proposal, the local tax would be about $728 million.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Wait a sec. Say that in 2042, the local taxes will be $5.7 billion?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So under current law and our baseline modeling assumptions, if we assumed that the project went forward, regardless, the total local project property tax would be about $5.7 billion cumulatively through 2042. And that's the tax burden that's being relieved through this legislation.
That's cumulative, if I can imagine. Cumulative, yes. from what year to 2042?
From current through 2042.
Okay, so 2027.
And then that compares to $728 million to the municipalities through the alternative volumetric tax, again, cumulatively.
Yes, Senator Klayman requests that you repeat those two numbers.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, so I provided a cumulative through calendar year 2042 estimate of local property tax paid under the project, if we assume that the project goes forward regardless, would be $5.7 billion. And under the alternative volumetric tax, that cumulative revenue would be $728 million.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just to clarify, is that the local or is that including the state as well?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so those are the local contributions. The total cumulative property tax assumption would be $8.4 billion under current law if we assume that the project went forward. And then the total alternative volumetric tax over that time period would be $829 million, again, cumulatively.
It is now 5:07. Thank you, Mr. Stickle, for joining us. We have reached the end of our meeting. We will be having you back. Thank you for your patience on this. So at this time, we will conclude our meeting. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday at 3:30. We will have three bills before us. Senate Joint Resolution 20, Clean Up Marine Debris, Senate Bill 208, Agricultural Land Leases, and HJR 18, Urging Support for Alaska LNG. So at this time, let the record reflect the meeting is adjourned at 5:07 p.m.